Welcome to the sixth session of the class in International Relations and European Integration. What I will first do today is just say something about modern liberalism, meaning the empirical study through liberal lenses. And I will particularly focus on the democratic piece. And this is liberal because you look into states and see how domestic politics affects then international relations. And the basic notion is here that democratic states do not fight wars against each other. The second and the third part of today's session is then linked to the democratic piece, and it looks at challenges to them through the media system, but also through the manipulation of public attitudes towards war and peace. And here the notion of the rally around the flag plays an important role. But let's move first and say something about modern liberalism. You already know some of the guys that appear here on this slide. So you have Robert Axelrod and Robert Cohen. Robert Axelrod is the person who founded, through his computer simulations, neoliberal institutionalism. And the other three scholars, Deutsch, Singer, and Rossett, they made important contributions over the years and decades through the liberal research program, looking at non-realist factors. Okay, what is this liberal research agenda? You can basically distinguish three main hypotheses, and they have been called in the 1990s by Joseph Nye, commercial liberalism, democratic liberalism, and regulatory liberalism. Commercial liberalism just means that trade and other forms of economic interactions, economic integration, economic interdependence between states makes these states more peaceful. Simply because they could lose the benefits from trade when their state leaders decide to launch a war, to launch an armed conflict. Democratic liberalism, this is the democratic peace hypothesis, that democratic pairs of states do not wage wars against each other. So the notion that plays a role here and that you need to understand is the so-called dyad. And the dyad is simply a pair of states. This is a technical term, and the hypothesis of the democratic peace principally states that democratic dyads do not experience war on sets. Regulatory liberalism puts the same optimistic expectations to the activities of international governmental organizations. And international governmental organizations are also then abbreviated through the acronym IGOs, that these international governmental organizations, together with the norms appearing in international law or other international law, norms which are not codified, they make state interactions more peaceful. These three factors were then called the Kantian peace by two of the main scholars in this area, Bruce Rossett and John O'Neill, and they believe that the tripod of forces, democracy, international organization, and economic interdependence alone, but also jointly, make state interactions more peaceful. As the notion of the Kantian peace suggests, this can be trace back this conviction, this liberal hope, can be traced back to the Enlightenment, to the Königsberg philosopher Immanuel Kant. But Immanuel Kant was not the only one who was formulating such ideas. Similar ideas were voiced by Montesquieu. Kant published Zum ewigen Frieden, a small pamphlet in 1795, Eternal Peace. Montesquieu made his contributions largely with regard to commercial liberalism already earlier. Political economists like Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill have taken up these notions that people, business people, have a particular interest in peaceful relations. Their interests in general are opposite to war interests. Norman Angell, writer of the 20th century, put his particular hope then in trade and economic interactions. And he believed that war would become unfathomable in a highly interdependent world. This was obviously a sad prediction in 1909, simply because of the fact that 5 years later the Great War broke out. Angell nevertheless received the Peace Nobel Prize in the beginning of the 1930s. The empirical regularity of the democratic peace was established by a scholar who was not working in the field, by Pabst, already by the turn of the 1960s to the 1970s. It was taken up by Small and Singer. You have seen a picture of David Singer before. And then Doyle, a political philosopher who contributed an empirical study to about this regularity to the American Political Science Review. Rossett and O'Neill have published a lot in this area. One book covering the Kantian peace was published by Norton Press in 2001. Okay, the democratic peace is a hypothesis on different levels of analysis. It's most firmly established at a dyadic level. There is also another level of analysis, which is called the monadic level. And this is then the hypothesis that democracies are more peaceful than autocracies. And this is something which is contested. Now, most people would believe in this particular hypothesis. This hypothesis also suggests that democracies fight wars against autocracies. Jack Levy, a political science professor at Rutgers University in the United States, said already in the 1980s that the democratic peace is what is closest to an empirical law in the study of international relations. But obviously people were then contributing different cases that might contradict this optimistic hypothesis. Okay, one level of analysis that is also playing a role is the systemic level of analysis. You recall from structural realism that it makes about a hypothesis about the distribution of power at the global level. And here, the systemic expectation is that a system of democratic states would be peaceful. So, and as you see and as you know, the relative number, but also the absolute number of democracies has grown over the decades. There was a certain glip most recently. Democratic leaders, not surprisingly, they just love the democratic peace. And there were different democratic leaders who have more or less directly used the phrase. So you see here as an example, the first example, Maggie Thatcher, the British Prime Minister, 9 years, or some years after the Falklands War, came up with saying that democracies don't go to war with one another. Bill Clinton said something similar, and then George W. Bush explicitly said, our aim is democratic peace, when he was talking about the Middle East. George W. Bush did some of his university studies at Yale University, where Bruce Russert is still a professor emeritus of political science, and Professor Russert was obviously deeply distressed about this interpretation of the democratic peace, that you could bring peace and democracy to the Middle East through the Second Gulf War. Okay, so you have seen then other such statements, sometimes also by European leaders, Chris Patten, but also French President Hollande. Okay, when you talk about the democratic peace, you obviously have to think about what constitutes a democracy. There are different data sets out there, and these different data sets buy into different conceptualizations of peace. Polity looks at it largely through the lenses of executive constraints. So whether there is a separation of power, whether, for instance, a president has to consult parliament before calling the army to defend the borders, and so on. In the polity data set, these executive constraints should make the crucial difference. Other definitions are more modest, and there is a data set by Golder, and he uses the minimal definition, which was established by Brzezinski, but also by Schumpeter, an Austrian economist who later became a professor at Harvard. And this interpretation uses a minimal definition of democracy, and it just relies on whether or not there are regular elections and whether these elections are free and fair. So the consequence of this is that you have a binary distinctions, not an ordinary scale like you have for polity, which measures different levels of constraints on the chief decision maker, or then even continuous measures like they are used by a Swedish project, the VDEM project, situated at the University of Göteborg. Obviously, there are also countries which are in the middle between autocracies and democracies, and these countries are then mixed types, sometimes also called anocracies. How can we explain the democratic peace? There have been early explanations. Just recall, first, it was an empirical regularity, and such empirical regularities, laws, call for explanations. And one of the earliest one is the structural explanation. And it focuses exactly on this constraint that the chief executive faces. They come through elections, they come through the separation of powers, but also through the individual freedoms granted to the civilian population. The normative explanation is closely linked then to the beliefs held by the population. So such populations which are democratic gradually embrace democratic norms. And these democratic norms also entail that you will search for a peaceful resolution in case that there is a conflict between two states. And this is especially important if a democratic leader faces another democratic leader, because then in such a situation, these leaders are believed to anticipate that the other side thinks in a similar way as he or she does. So, and the general expectation is here that these democracies then also believe that they can solve their dispute through peaceful means, through negotiations, or sometimes even also by calling then a mediator, a third party, which assists them in solving their conflict. Okay, there is also a third classic interpretation through more or less realist lenses. As you know, we do not only have balance of power thinking, but we have also a school of thought called power preponderance or power transition theory, which looks at the leading power and the potential challenger. And if this potential challenger is now emerging in world politics, a democratic challenger is satisfied then more easily with the status quo than an autocracy, because these democracies, they do not need to expand territorially, for instance. There have been attempts to integrate democratic peace theory in the standard crisis bargaining models that you know already quite well. The first one is by Jim Fearon, and Jim Fearon basically used the notion then of resolve. Resolve simply means how strongly you are committed to your bargaining position. And he believes that democracies have an advantage in signaling to the other side what they mean. And a similar model has been developed by Ken Schultz, who is now a professor, as Jim Fearon is, at Stanford University. And the basic hypothesis that one can derive from his writing, that again, the support of the opposition makes deterrence work better. These threats to use force are more convincing. So you see the interaction on the lower left, the figure here, typical crisis bargaining situation. You start out with a move here by the government, which can challenge the status quo. But when you are a democratic government, you have to consult the opposition, as I've said beforehand. And importantly, the opposition can support or oppose the usage of force. And then in the next move here, the other state has to decide on whether to give in or whether to risk the confrontation. And if it does the latter, then the government moves again by deciding between backing down or standing firm. The important result here is summarized in figure two, lower right figure two. So what you see here are just simulations, which are also called comparative statics. In this figure, you see here first the probability of certain outcomes, no challenge, bluffs, genuine challenges, or confirmed challenges. Confirmed challenges are the ones supported then by the opposition. And you see here how the probability of such outcomes depends then on whether or not you have an opposition. So the first result here is that the probability that no challenge is made is larger if you are democratic and face an opposition with whom you have to consult in such an interaction. So this basically means at the monadic level of analysis that democratic states are more peaceful, because they challenge another state less frequently. They are also less frequently bluffing, because they would obviously then have here a defeat if the opposition does not, a domestic defeat, experience a domestic defeat, if the opposition does not support them. And then you also see here that the probability of these confirmed challenges obviously is much larger, the ones where you have the support by the opposition. Okay, so as I said, these results depend very much on the level of analysis. You can distinguish the three levels here: monadic, dyadic, systemic. And I will give you an illustration of one of the key empirical findings here, John O'Neill and Bruce Russell together with Michael Birbaum. And what they do in these tables, they calculate, just again, comparative statics, the annual probability of the onset of a militarized dispute at the dyadic level. And this is our comparative statics because you change then the values of particular explanatory variables and see how this affects then particular outcomes. Okay, here is this table. To the very right, you see here all onset. First, when for contiguous diets, you see here that all these variables are set at the 10th percentile of all these diets included in the analysis. And no disputes in the previous 16 years. Okay, if you have this at the outset of the analysis, you have a probability that a diet experiences a conflict of 0.02%. If you now increase the level of democracy, so this variable is changed to the 19th percentile and all the other variables remain at the baseline value, you see a dramatic reduction in all onsets of 66%. If you only look at the subset of fatal militarized interstate disputes, meaning where the confrontation includes the usage of armed force, where some soldiers die on a battlefield, then you see even a reduction of almost 90%. If you look at the other Kantian variables here, then you see here that they reduce the probability of a dyadic dispute also, but to a lesser extent. Some of the realist control variables, allies, doesn't have an effect, but other realist variables, where you look, for instance, at the capability ratio, then this reduces the risk of conflict to a considerable extent. And if you take everything jointly together, these variables, then you see here that you reduce the risk of a fatal militarized interstate dispute of a MIT by 95% in comparison to the baseline. So these are non-trivial influences. Other people have looked at democracy then in more refined ways and established more clearer regularities. This is also based on a theoretical model that is close to the model by, or the models by, Scholz and Fearon. I will explain the model later on. So first, some regularities which you have seen before, but here regularity 3 is important. Democracies fight wars that they can win, with the consequence that they win a disproportionate share of the wars that they fight. This is true at the monadic level. They are also more likely to choose mechanisms like mediations and so on. I have mentioned this beforehand. There is a finding that because they can signal their interests more clearly, they are more likely to initiate wars against autocracies than autocracies against democracies. What these authors, Bruce Brunner de Mesquita and his colleagues, also have established, and this is similar to the third regularity, is that the human losses are smaller because democratic leaders have to think about the welfare of their citizens, and the wars are comparatively shorter. I will not explain here the other regularities that they establish. Okay, what is the model on which this is based? They distinguish within a society of two main forces, the selectorate and the winning coalition, which is missing an I here. I'm sorry about that. So you have the selectorate. The selectorate selects the leaders. So think about a communist regime. In a communist regime, like you have in North Korea, which is obviously a quasi-monarchic communist regime, you probably have the father, perhaps even including the mother, then selecting the next kin. So this is then the selectorate, and some people have to confirm that this is now the leader of this country. In a democracy, this is the electorate, the citizens who have the right to vote. So 50% of the voters, the median voter, is the decisive person here. In an autocracy, the winning coalition is much smaller. So we do not really know what happens then in North Korea, but it could be that the Politburo in some way has to confirm whether the right Kim or whether the right sister to Kim has been selected as the next leader of North Korea. So, relatively small selectorates in autocracies and small winning coalitions in autocracies, larger winning coalitions in democracies. This electorate might also be larger. So in democracies, most often leaders are selected through party congresses. So this electorate includes then several hundred voters, party members. If they make a referendum, a ballot about that, then the this electorate contains several thousand or several 10,000 potential supporters then of the next potential leader in a country. What is now important is that the members of this electorate, they are interested in private goods. The members of the winning coalition, think about citizens in the democracies, they are largely interested in the public good, goods that the government provides, education, security, and so on. And what now matters is whether the leader has to work for the public goods or whether he has just to compensate his or her friends with cars, seats on state-run companies and so on, so private goods that they might obtain for having selected this particular leader. So this mixture of private and public goods is important on whether such a leader can stay in office in the long term. And they believe that this gives support for the notion that after a lost war, democratic leaders are more likely to lose office than autocratic leaders. They're not saying that autocratic leaders can remain in office, but they're less likely to be thrown out by this electorate, by a public uprising and so on, of office. And here you see out of the textbook just these diverse probability. If the war outcome is very large, then a leader is very likely to lose power. And this especially looms large for democratic leaders, as you see here in figure B. Okay, there has been criticisms of the democratic peace. You see here some of these criticisms, and you should then for the mini break think about what kind of expectations to this trend are. Obviously, realists do not believe in that. They believe balance of power, polarity, and so on is much more influential. A more interesting hypothesis has been advanced by Mansfield and Snyder. They believe that democratizing states are a risk in international politics, but also domestically, because they are fighting wars. This is contested. Also contested is the notion of capitalist peace, whether the influence of a capitalist structure of the economy supersedes the influence of democratic institutions. I will talk about this later on in this class. Okay, thank you for listening. Welcome to the second part of session 6. I will talk about media manipulation and foreign policy, and then also cover media effects. This part and the next part of session 6 is covered with the question on whether government leaders find support for their policies through their voters. And what you often observe is the so-called rally around the flag effect. But the question arises here whether media and obviously also politicians can manipulate here this rally around the flag effect, and whether they can become more popular and win then later on elections. So let's first look at media effects. So what we have here as media effects has a long tradition. Many anecdotes about that occurred over the years, and the first ones are associated with the name of William Randolph Hearst, who was the owner of many papers in the United States by the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries. And one incident is particularly famous, and this is expressed through the exchange of cables between a reporter, Remington, and Hearst. Hearst did not want to stay in Cuba, but Hearst requested him for doing so. There was a conflict between the United States and Spain over this island, and Hearst replied to the reporter who wanted to go home, "Please remain, you furnish the pictures, I will furnish the war." Hearst became the role model for Citizen Kane, a role in a movie directed by Orson Welles, one of the movies I really recommend you watching. It always is on the top of the lists of the best movies ever produced. Citizen Kane is played by Orson Welles himself. He's played as a neurotic person, and when you watch the movie, you will figure out why the last word that he says on the deathbed is Rosebud. Okay, there are other anecdotes that try to explain the effect of media on foreign policy making. I just want to single out here the so-called CNN factor. And the CNN factor was described by George Bush Sr., who said that I learn more from CNN than I do from the CIA. And this is particularly ironic because George Bush Sr. Was at one point of time also the head of the CIA. Obviously, the media system changes a lot over time. So what now plays a role are social media, and this you do not only know from the Twitter in chief residing in the White House, but also from other politicians. So I have the same figure that was on the previous slide also here. And this shows you just one phenomenon that we quickly find that the interest in a particular event quickly fades out. So what you see here are the tweets per second in the night when there were first rumors about the killing of Osama bin Laden, and then later on the confirmation that this terrorist leader had been killed by US forces. So what matters in the international system is then just the bias the media system introduces through its technology, nowadays also social media, but also if you have then newspapers or TV chains due to their commercial interests. So you have a set of international events, but only a subset of these events is reported about. So what is important here is the so-called news value theory, which is the cornerstone of all these studies, these selections, and then later on distortions that happen from the objective events to the consumption of these events by the people reading about them or watching them on TVs or on their laptops. And this is an approach, this news value theory developed by Johann Galtung in the 1960s. And I have just one example for this news value theory here. So what you see here to the right is just the network coverage of different types of events by the main TV chains in the US. And you see here that there is an overproportional focus on armed conflict. Africa is portrayed as a conflict beset, as a continent beset by armed conflict, by terrorism, and so on. But you do not see any reports on this TV change about normal life. So, for instance, only ABC reported about women and family issues. You do not see any reports about the economic development of the African states. When you look at the countries that are portrayed and which ones not, then what you see here that for instance, Liberia is largely is covered in a lot of these reports, Egypt, Libya, and so on. These are countries in which this period of time there were also conflicts happening, or which had active foreign policy. Egypt is an ally of the United States. If you try to explain this ranking order, what explains this are economic ties of the U.S. With these states. This is primarily important for this ranking list, so trade, but also whether these countries have, relatively speaking, an important economy. How can we explain these distortions that happen because of the media? The literature distinguishes here three mechanisms: agenda setting, framing, and priming. Agenda setting is relatively easy to understand. It simply means it matters whether an event is reported as the first event, whether it appears on the front page of the newspaper, or whether it's in the foreign policy section of the newspaper, or if it is a TV or a radio report, if it's just appearing after some minutes into the program. Framing and priming are more subtle mechanisms. First, framing means that it depends on what the issue, specific issue, is on which the media focus. So take, for instance, a terrorist event. It matters very much on whether the report focuses on the perpetrator or on the victims. So certain media systems try to prevent an overly large focus on the perpetrators. France, for instance, does not report the names of terrorists with the intention that they should not become heroes through their actions. So, but nevertheless, the framing still matters on how then attitudes are built among the consumers of this news. Priming is similar, and it just means on whether then foreign policy in general plays, for instance, a bigger role, and then it plays also a greater role in the political judgment. And this is then very close to the war rally effect. So it might then be that an active foreign policy agenda might compensate for a not so good performance in the economic realm by the president or the prime minister. Here, first, a general study on how media bias influences public attitudes. And this has to do, this study, with the second war against Iraq. And in the second war against Iraq, one of the main justification for the attack of the United States and its allies on Saddam Hussein were the alleged plans by Saddam Hussein of obtaining nuclear weapons. And what you see here, that the more misperceptions people have about this possession of weapons of mass destructions or not, and this was turned out to be a complete lie, the more they are supportive of the plans to attack Iraq. And you see here that it matters whether or not you are watching Fox News or other TV channels. Fox News viewers have the highest average rate of misperceptions and are thus by extensions more supportive of this particular war plan. And the least supportive by extensions are then the ones listening to National Public Radio, NPR, or watching the public broadcasting system, PBS. So here you have condensed all three effects, which I repeat are agenda setting, framing, or priming. So what is agenda setting? Here is a study that explains all these three mechanisms through nice illustrations. So this just shows how salient for the American electorate were in the year in which the first Gulf War happened, particular issues, the economy, the budget deficit, drugs and crime, or then Gulf-related war fears. And you see here that this appeared to be a topic from July on and then dropped later on in March when the United States became victorious in this particular conflict. But for a certain period of time, there was a larger focus than on the war, than on the economic crisis. And this also affects then how the leader at this period of time, President George Bush, was evaluated. So you see here that the foreign policy and the performance played a bigger role, and George W. Bush could, to some extent at least, compensate for the economic crisis during this period because it played just a bigger role for the voters. In the end, it didn't help him because he was not re-elected. Bill Clinton was the next president after that, and he became president largely because of the bad management of the economy by George Bush. Okay, there is also a framing effect uncovered in this study. So TV news largely focuses on the military side, and what the two authors establish here, that the respondents' support for military rather than a diplomatic response depends on whether or not they receive their news primarily through the TV or through other media channels. So there is a positive impact you see here in the last column. You also see that this impact is a significant one. I would like you now to think about whether the same kind of effect can also be observed for German policymaking in general, but also German foreign policy making, whether you see agenda setting here, particularly in times of economic crisis or not, and what factors work against that. Welcome to this last part of session 6. I will talk about whether or not the public, the electorate, can be manipulated in wars and whether following the leader is a rational reaction to an international crisis. Let's first start with a look at the views, the attitudes of the voters towards foreign policy. And the groundbreaking work was made independently of each other by Walter Lippmann and Gabriel Almond, and they claimed that the attitudes of voters towards foreign policy issues are volatile, that it lacks coherence, and at, in the end, given these two characteristics, it does have only little impact on foreign policy. The question then is whether this is true or not. And this has been challenged, and two American public communication scholars, Shapiro and Page, coined the phrase of the rational public. They believe that indeed attitudes have an impact on foreign policy and that they are much more stable, so that they cannot that easily be manipulated. And they have done so, establishing this particular relationship, establishing this particular empirical pattern by looking at numerous public opinion polls. Okay, so what you see here is a study that shows that this is also the case for Western Europe. And you see here how frequent changes are and whether there were changes over the time. Isania, Schuhas, and Rottingham find very much the same for France, Germany, and Italy. So this means that foreign policy attitudes of voters are formed by the influences from the international environment. And if there is a crisis, then it's most likely also that a large part of the population see this as a crisis. Obviously, notwithstanding the effect that agenda setting, framing and priming might then in the end have on these attitudes. But if the international environment stays the same, then also these attitudes do not change dramatically over time. Okay, so what does then influence here attitudes of the voters for foreign policy making? And you see here from this particular study by Goldsmith and his co-author that here foreign policy opinion has a strong impact on how then the government behaves. So this is something which also holds true for Germany. So there is a study by a former member of our department by Anselm Hager, who is now a professor at Humboldt University in Berlin. And he was able to look at all the polls conducted by the office of Chancellor Angela Merkel. And what they found, that the language that Angela Merkel uses for her policy statements are largely influenced by what the population in Germany in the aggregate believes. So a very direct impact through these polls, as documented by the study by Anselm Hager and his co-author, recently published in the American Journal of Political Science. There is nevertheless, notwithstanding the rational public thesis, an old school of thought which looks at the possibility that leaders in a situation of a domestic crisis, if the public believes that they do not perform well as manager of the economy, then they might have a tendency to find an international scapegoat. This was already articulated by Baudin in the 16th century. The best way of preserving a state is to find an enemy against whom the subjects can make common cause. More generally, this was translated into the in-group, out-group thesis by Simmel, that if you find an enemy outside, your group, your own group becomes more cohesive. And this was then also phrased by Ralph Dahrendorf succinctly in the 1960s. As you know, Ralph Dahrendorf is the patron saint of the University of Constance, and he was an influential sociologist in the 1960s and 1970s before becoming a commissioner in the European Commission and later on an academic in Great Britain and the United States. Similar reasoning plays a role in the theory of imperialism. So, however, there is very diverse, very mixed empirical evidence in support of the diversionary theory of war. Take one well-known example, the Falkland War. Media immediately raised the expectation that this successful military adventure from the perspective of Great Britain helped in the re-election campaign of Margaret Thatcher later on. President Clinton was also accused of using Iraq and sporadic attacks on the troops of Saddam Hussein as a distraction to the Levinsky affair that he faced by the end towards or in the middle of his second term. When you look at the textbook, then you also see that when you have such a rally in the negotiations from the perspective of crisis bargaining, your negotiation stance becomes much better. So a rally around the flag effect, public opinion affects your negotiation position, but that's not what we are concerned here about. The diversionary theory of war suggests that state leaders can use here militarized disputes, they can use wars as an instrument to boost their public popularity and to boost their re-election chance. This is the question whether this is then really the case, but even for the Falkland Wars, this is not completely clear. An original study by Patrick Don Levy, a professor at the London School of Economics, claimed that the Falkland Wars boosted the popularity of the government of Margaret Thatcher. But a later study by Sanders and colleagues published in the British Journal of Political Science some years after this war has shown that this Falkland Wars, the Malvinas Wars, how it is called from the Argentinian perspective, did not have a significant impact on government popularity. And you see this visualized in figure one. So the Falkland Wars crisis begins then in April 1982. And you see here also that the starting point when government popularity increased again was some months earlier. So the turning point was before that. And the influence that is exerting here a significant impact on government popularity is the expectations of the British voters or whether the economy is performing in the right direction. There might have been a small, but this study suggests, negligible impact of the Falkland Wars on the popularity of the Thatcher government. But what you also observe in all these studies, that this bonus that you receive out of this engagement on the international scene, that this disappears quite quickly. So this war honeymoon is quickly over. And this you see also in the two figures reproduced here. So in basically all these studies, you see here a decline over time, and this is especially the case if the number of people who have died in these conflicts is large. This is what you see in the lower right on this particular slide. So take the Vietnam War, but also take the Korean War. World War II is here an exception, certainly because this was a world war and because of the entry of the United States into this war is considered to be a justified event. Okay, so what you see here that there is an impact of the number of war deaths on this discount of the war rally effect on government popularity. And this is also what Voeten and Brewer have found in their study on the war in Iraq. So what you see here is a table including different outcome and variables. So change in war success, people, the number of people, or the changing number of people believing that this war will be a success, the change of the support and approval of Bush for the way how he handles the war in Iraq, and then in the end, the overall, the change in the overall support for the Bush presidency. And important is then that it's not the change from one period of time to the next period of time in the number of casualty that influences at least then the first evaluation war success, but the cumulative number that is used here. And what the authors use here is the logarithm, and it's lagged for the preceding period in order to have a more causal estimate here. And then obviously particular events throughout the war boost shortly then the chance of the incumbent who is President Bush the second. So you see, for instance, here the capture of Saddam Hussein increases the popularity, but as you have seen on the picture, that these boosts are just short-lived events. So war rallies exist, but they do not last in most cases for a very long period of time. And with this, I want to finish session 6. Thank you.